Hello, this is Gidon Rothstein. Thank you for joining us for a responsum a day for the 5th of Av. This is going to be a responsum of Rav Moshe Feinstein about educating the daughter of a conservative rabbi. This is a responsum from Yoredeya Chelek Hei, the 5th volume of Yoredeya, Siman Lamed Chet, responsum number 38, from the 5th of Av of Tuf Shin Lamed Bet of 5732, which was 1972. Rav Moshe writes that he had gotten the letters from the man, and he has to respond, even though I am in my days of rest, meaning it's Av, so it's Ben Azmanim. It's the time, I think, when people went up to camp, they went up to the country, they went, and Rav Moshe saw it as a time of rest. He needed to rest from his labors, and that idea of vacation is an idea he's saying, I need to take to rest, but nonetheless, he felt this was such an urgent situation, he felt the need to respond to this question. And this is the story. This rabbi who was writing him apparently had a student in his class or in his school, a young woman, and her father was a conservative rabbi. And she is in a class with other young women, and while they're teaching, so the rabbi had felt, and Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to agree in some ways but not in others, that it was very important to explain to the young woman, this is the early 1970s when the tension between the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement was even more significant than it is now by virtue of the fact that Orthodoxy was not as well established in the United States of America as it has become, and therefore it was a continuing tense situation. And this rabbi, who's a teacher or a principal, felt that it was vital to explain and be clear to the students the great damage that the conservative rabbis were creating by virtue of the version of Judaism they were promoting. Meaning, to background, Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't say this explicitly, but meaning, if they're going to promote a version of Judaism in which certain things are acceptable and appropriate and allowed and seen as part of what's okay for Jews to do, and this Orthodox rabbi and other Orthodox rabbis don't think it's true, they don't hold of it, as we would say, then that's a problem. And they are promoting and propagating a version of Judaism that we find problematic. So this teacher is saying that you need to make that clear to the students so that they can understand what damage the conservative rabbis are doing. And when they do that, this young woman, who is the daughter of a conservative rabbi, is embarrassed, and she cries about it. She's very upset about it because this rabbi, this teacher who's turning to Rav Moshe for advice, calls them Rishaim, calls them evildoers. And that would apply to her father as well. And she doesn't want to think of her father as an evildoer. She's very upset about it. She comes to talk to her teacher or her principal about it. And he's unhappy about it because he feels obligated to make this point to the students. And so he doesn't know what to do. And he says that others have said to him that you have to worry about this, because if she doesn't feel comfortable and he continues to stress this point, she might leave the school. So if she leaves the school and she goes to another school, she might stop getting an Orthodox education. Right now she's getting a good chinuch, she's getting a good education, and therefore you'd want to try to retain her, meaning even especially if you value Orthodoxy as opposed to conservatism, you want to retain her in the Orthodox world. But the man writing to Rav Moshe says that unless he attacks the conservative rabbis and makes clear how terrible they are and how what they're doing for Judaism, that she and maybe other students in the class will become comfortable with the conservative way of working the world, and she'll think that it's plausible and possible to be a perfectly fine, upstanding Jewish woman while adhering to the conservative movement and having a good character and things like that. So before we get to Rav Moshe's, and his question is, how should he handle it? So before we get to Rav Moshe's answer, and we will, but before we get to this answer, it strikes me, and I think it bears paying attention, this is from 1972, it's over 40 years ago, but it gets at a very important question in terms of when we do and don't have certain kinds of students in our schools, how that affects the kind of chinuch, the kind of education we give. Now, Rav Moshe is going to give an answer that I think is fairly judicious, and we'll get to it. But even if we are judicious about these things, to recognize, whatever the answer will be in a particular situation, but to recognize that when we accept students in schools, that governs how we're able to express ourselves and the kinds of issues we're able to express ourselves about and the ways in which we're able to express ourselves. So here, Moshe is going to give an answer that could apply, and he's going to say, here's a good way to do it, whatever it is. But I feel like in our times, there are certain situations that come up as well, where once somebody's in a school, then all of a sudden, the way we can express ourselves on those issues changes because we have to accommodate them, and that's not always part of the calculus when we think about that. So that's for another time, because we're here for our response of the day. So here's where Rav Moshe starts to answer. He says he thinks you have to handle this with a great deal of care and a great deal of thought, and that what you should do is to speak about faith issues, where what all Jews are required to believe, that all Jews are required to believe. I mean, he's going to say, start with the very basics. All Jews are required to believe in a Torah that came down from Sinai, brought by Moshe Rabbeinu, with a written Torah and an oral Torah. And that's clear, he says, in Shas and in Poskim, in the Talmud, and in everybody who came afterwards, that that's a necessary belief for Jews. Pause for us to notice that Rav Moshe is very clear about that. Sadly, I'm not sure that all Orthodox Jews today are, but Rav Moshe is very clear that it's just unequivocally accepted in Orthodoxy and in traditional Judaism throughout the generations that the Torah that we have, the written and the oral, came down in some sense from Moshe at Har Sinai, and if somebody objects to that belief, they're not really part of traditional Judaism. And it's a sheker, he says, it's a falsehood. Divrei ha-conservativim v'ha-reformer, when the conservative and reform say it's not true, that's a kfiram b'ikarei ha-emunah. That is a denial of fundamental faith propositions of Orthodoxy, of Torah, of Judaism. But he says, there's no need to call them rishaim. You don't have to call them evildoers. You don't have to call them, he doesn't say you don't have to call them names, but you don't have to call them evildoers, because as long as you make it, now his point is, as long as you make it about the faith principles and say this is a faith principle that we in Orthodoxy have, she won't be upset about what you're saying, because she knows that Orthodoxy disagrees with the basic faith principles of the conservative movement. And she knows that we think of it as kfira, as heresy, as denial of what the Torah and what Hashem wants of us and the faith propositions we're supposed to have. What bothers her is when we call them Rishaim, when they call them evildoers. And therefore, he says, Feinstein says, there's no need to unnecessarily, and not with any real purpose, call them Rishaim. The next point is going to be a technical point about the definition of the word Rasha and how we use it in our times. But to stop there, to point out that this is what he's saying, and I fully accept what he's saying, I would only point out that some people might claim that there is a value in calling them Rishaim to point out the significance of it. Meaning, when one doesn't use terms like that, I'm not saying one always has to, but when one doesn't use terms like that, it can come off as a principal disagreement about a matter, but they have their opinion, we have our opinion. Whereas when Moshe uses the term kfira, and as we're going to see, he means it very significantly and very practically, halakhically, when Moshe uses the term kfira, heresy, that's a very serious thing. That's almost worse than being a rasha. So you're not going to use the word rasha. It's sort of like leaving out a piece of the puzzle in deference to this young woman's sensibilities, which I'm not saying is the wrong tactic to take. I'm just pointing out that it's requiring this teacher to take a certain tactic in order to be able to educate her in the right way. As it happens, when it comes to the word the rasha, he says, you know, people today use the word rasha, and they use the word evildoer in a completely different way than halacha does, right? Than the psukim do and the gemara does. And he points out to an earlier tshuva he had written. It's dated much later, but it's a tshuva that he points to, and he published in Eben Ezra Chelek Dalid, Siman Yud Gimel, where he says that when conservative rabbis do a kiddushin, perform a wedding, he has doubts about the validity of the wedding, because even if this conservative rabbi is an observant man, so I know conservative rabbis like this, who don't eat non-kosher, and they don't violate Shabbos when they go to shul, meaning one of the things the conservative movement did was it allowed people to drive to shul on Shabbat, and said it's so important to drive to shul, to get to shul on Shabbat, you can even drive. But there are many conservative rabbis who don't drive on Shabbat. So in those senses, the technical halachic senses, they seem to be observant, at least largely observant, and therefore would not seem to be out of the pale of observant Jews, and that therefore should mean that if they oversee a wedding, maybe it is a valid wedding. But Rav Moshe says that since he's a member of the conservative rabbinate, And the view of the conservative rabbi, Rav Moshe says, is that there are certain mitzvot in the Torah, in biblical mitzvot, that one is no longer required to keep, and many, many Isurim derabbanan, maybe the rabbinic propositions that they say you don't have to keep. And that alone, that claim, that idea, that we are allowed to judge mitzvot in the Torah and say we don't have to keep these, and we're allowed to judge rabbinic pronouncements and say, oh, we don't have to keep these anymore, he says that itself is a heresy. That renders one pasul le'idut, that renders one an invalid witness, because even though we haven't heard that this particular person has done anything wrong, he says the rabbi Minhilchos Eidus says, ha'apikorsin v'hamumarin, that the Ram says that when it comes to testimony and witnesses, there's no list that says that people who are apikorsim. Apikorsim in the Gemara meant something slightly different than we use it for today. An apikorsim in the Gemara was somebody who was blatantly and openly disrespectful of rabbis and of Chazal and of their teachings. And mumarim are people who have abandoned observance in some way. But apikorsim are also people who are lacking in faith, various faith propositions. So they're not included in those who aren't invalid for testimony. The Rambam says that's because they didn't need to, because they're so much worse even than Rishei Yisrael. Rishei Yisrael are Jews, are observant Jews. They're just observant Jews who have done something so wrong that we call them Rishaim. But Abikorsim and Mumrim, the Rambam says, are Pchutim min ha'akum, are even less than idolaters. And that's because, and what I'm going to mention now is a halacha that appears in the Gemara and is very accepted in the Gemara, but that we today wouldn't think of applying in practice because of issues of Dina d'makut Dina. We have to follow the law of the land and things like that. But at the time of the Gemara, there was a halacha that if somebody saw an idolater who was in a life-threatening situation, then we wouldn't help them if there wasn't going to be a Chilul Hashem. Meaning if nobody else is around in the halacha and the Gemara, I'm not saying we apply it today, and it's a complicated discussion, but Rav Moshe is bringing it up for the purpose that he's getting to in his tshuva, so I'm just going to refer to it and then leave it. But the halacha of the Gemara was, if somebody saw a non-Jew in a place, they were all alone, nobody would ever know, and the non-Jew was in a life-threatening situation, was likely to die, not just the non-Jew, the idolater, was likely to die unless the Jew saved him, the Jew could avoid saving the non, should avoid saving the non-Jew. The way the Gemara expressed that is, lo malin v'lo moridin, that if we find them in a pit in which they would die, we don't bring them up from the pit, but we don't find ways to get them down into the pit. We don't like to try to engineer their demise. But when it comes to apikorsim and mumri, when it comes to people lacking in faith, or people who mistreat Chazal, or people who have abandoned the religion in a more general sense, so there the Gemara thought, and I'm not saying we apply this today in this way for various reasons, but those people, the Gemara's halacha was moridin velo ma'alin. We would even try to engineer their demise if we could. The Rambam's point being that if you see that that's the attitude that Chazal had towards these people, it's clear that they would not have accepted their testimony as valid because we couldn't have trusted them to give valid testimony. All that is relevant to that particular tshuva, that particular responsum, because it explains why Rav Moshe thinks that a conservative rabbi cannot be taken to be a valid witness, and therefore when he oversees a wedding, unless there are valid witnesses at the wedding, or he oversees a wedding, that might ruin the wedding itself, because he himself, by virtue of his membership in the conservative rabbinate, becomes one of these people, because he says, we don't need any witnesses to say that this person is a mumar, right, is a heretic, or is somebody who's left the religion in a general way, because that's also true for the Moridin issue. When the Gemara talks about that we would bring about people's demise, the Gemara doesn't say, and you need to have witnesses to this and to prove it, because it's not a court procedure. It depends on, and this is one of the places where these kinds of issues get problematic and sticky, because it depends on how well-known it is. Now, the words well-known mean different things to different people. The example that pops to mind, that Rav Moshe obviously doesn't raise, but the example that pops to mind is that in Yigal Amir's mind, when he shot Yitzchak Rabin, Yitzchak Rabin was a rodef. So that's a terrible tragedy that occurred. I think that it's a complete misunderstanding of how immediate the radifa has to be, how immediate the threat to other Jews has to be, to other people has to be, in order to qualify somebody as a rodef. That's a halachic discussion of its own. But it highlights the idea that when it comes to extrajudicial punishments, when it comes to the Gemara and halacha allowing people to act on their own without turning to a court for an answer, so that depends on everybody knowing it. But when everybody knows something, it's not always the same level of knowledge. It's not always the same understanding. So that would be a question of meaning. So let's say I said, well, such and such rabbi is clearly a heretic, and therefore his kiddusha and his weddings are clearly invalid. That would be a difficult thing to do, and I think it's clear. So if I think it's clear, the Rav Moshe seems to be saying, and I found that person, and I found the way to engineer their demise, not in our times, but in the time of the Gemara, I would have been allowed to do that, and therefore it should have been clear that that person's invalid to be a witness, and therefore it should be clear that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that gets to be a problematic sequence of ideas to think about and to work on. But Rav Moshe is saying that in our situation, you don't have to go that far because there's nothing more famous, there's nothing more well-known, nothing more clear that if somebody adheres to the conservative movement, if they identify with the conservative movement to deny many of the principles of the Torah, many actual halachot, but also to deny the whole, and this was in the early 70s, so what people today believe in the conservative movement, I don't know, but if the movement as a whole believes that the whole idea of a revelation at Sinai and the acceptance of Torah at Sinai is untrue, so then if somebody becomes a rabbi in a conservative shul, Rav Moshe is saying, and even, and this is even much more true then than it is now, even if the person is doing it purely for his livelihood, meaning, and this certainly used to be true when I was growing up in the 80s, I knew people whose fathers were rabbis in conservative synagogues, they said it's because they couldn't make a living. They didn't find the shul an Orthodox shul. There were, at the time, plenty of Orthodox rabbis who would go from shul to shul and not make a good living. And some people made the decision, well, I can find a conservative synagogue. I can do good work with them. I can try to teach them Torah. I can try to bring them closer to Judaism. And I'll make a living. So Rav Moshe is saying that even if that's the only reason that one does it, it doesn't matter. Because in terms of kefira, in terms of heresy, which he's saying membership in the conservative movement inherently accepts certain heresies. It's not like one could really, I always used to hear this phrase, oh, he's an Orthodox rabbi, he just happens to be in the conservative movement, which meant he observes halacha the same way as we observe halacha, just he happens to work in a conservative synagogue. Rav Moshe is saying that for a rabbi, that's not possible. And it's not possible because by virtue of being a rabbi in the conservative movement, one is, by virtue of being a rabbi in that movement, accepting certain ideas that that movement promotes, and those ideas are heretical ideas, and therefore the person has become, in that sense, a heretic. And Rav Moshe says, and this is in the earlier tshuva, but we're going to get back to our tshuva about this young woman in this school, that in terms of heresy, he says, it doesn't matter if the person really believes the heresy, or the person simply profits off of espousing that heresy. So even the fact, Rav Moshe is saying, that somebody becomes a rabbi in a conservative synagogue to make a living, and therefore stays silent on these issues, right? Doesn't publicly say, and I break with the conservative movement all these issues, and I'm a fully Orthodox guy, and I believe in Orthodox principles. So that doesn't change the fact of being a heretic. That it's for financial reasons doesn't change it. In fact, he thinks it's even worse. Because halachically, if somebody transgresses certain parts of the Torah because they just are too tempted by them, that person is more clearly puzzled edus, unable to give testimony on that issue than a mumar lahachis, where there's an opinion in the Gemara that that person could do it.
But when it came to apikorsim and mumrim, Rav Moshe said, it's clear that those are serious averot, and a mumar as a rasha, every avera that is on sids that have malkot, so they would be a problem. And apikorsim, people who have the wrong faith, is what Rav Moshe is taking it as. It could be that even without doing any action, they're already considered apikorsim, even if there are no witnesses to it, as long as we know about it in some way. As long as somebody just says he's a kofar in public, he thinks that that's already, Rav Moshe thinks that's a chilul Hashem. Admitting in public or declaring in public one's contrary beliefs, that's a chilul Hashem, and therefore he thinks that would qualify, which means, this is the old tshuva still, that these conservative rabbis, where they are kofar when they deny many, many principles of the Torah, and then today you'd have to check out whether that's true of the conservative movement still and what it's true about, what it's not true about. But Rav Moshe is saying that once one denies principles of the Torah and halachos in the Torah, that denial itself turns one into a kofar, into a denier, into a heretic, and that itself could be good enough to make one invalid for testimony and to make one's weddings puzzle and not full weddings. This is an opinion of Rav Moshe's that I'm not sure has been fully accepted, but which, in fact, is a cool in a lot of ways. It's a lenient in a lot of ways, because that means that if somebody gets married by one of these rabbis and the wedding is invalid, then if, God forbid, they get divorced and the woman gets remarried without a valid get, you don't run into the problem of mamzerut, of the children of the second marriage being halachically
illegitimate, but it rests on these principles of how we understand the beliefs of the conservative movement, the beliefs of rabbis by virtue of their adhering to the conservative movement. That's a complicated question of its own. But his point is, and now he's coming back to the tshuva that we're dealing with today, the tshuva for the 5th of Av from 1972, that somebody who transgresses a sin that would theoretically be punished by a court with lashes, that's what Russia really means. So Russia is somebody who eats non-kosher in front of two witnesses. If somebody eats non-kosher without witnesses there, they're not quite a Russia. Or they might be because it's an Aver Sheyesh B'Malka. But let's say somebody tells Lashon Hara where there's no lashes, and they tell it regularly. That's not technically, halachically, a Russia. Today, he says, people call somebody a Russia if they're Rab Midotav, if they're got flaws in their character, or they're cruel. Right? We say Haman a Russia. So Rav Moshe is saying, technically, Haman doesn't qualify as a Russia because he wasn't Jewish, and he didn't transgress those kinds of Isurim. Now, to some extent, I'm not sure if that's true, because Haman did transgress on the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. He transgressed on those halachot that applied to him. So I'm not sure what Rav Moshe really means about that. But he's taking an extremely technical view of the word Rasha, whereas I could have imagined somebody arguing back that it's the other way around. That definition of the word Rasha is only to give us some specific way that we can identify who's gone over the line to being a Russia. But somebody who is broadly bad in some way, we can say they're a Russia, because we can say, maybe, the response would have been to Rav Moshe, that you would say, well, if they do this, they're obviously a Russia. As Rav Moshe himself has seemed to have said about apikorsim, when he says they're clearly invalid for testimony, and they're clearly people who have denied the whole Torah, and they're clearly kofrim, so therefore they're kofrim, and therefore you can say their weddings don't count. So now when he's going to say here, but they don't quite qualify as Rishaim, he's taking a very, very strict stance on it. And I think he's doing it because he's trying to say that there's no vital need to tell this young woman that her father's a Rasha. He may be, by virtue of being a conservative rabbi, a kofer, a heretic. He may be denying faith principles of the Torah. So you say it that way. So I think that's what Moshe is trying to communicate. But he gets into it by saying, and this becomes a question in other contexts as well, as to when do we take a very narrow, strict constructionist view of things, and when do we say that words mean, have their connotations as well as their denotations, as well as their connotations, so that it's all included. In any case, coming back to our case of Kadom ben Nimsa Shalafi Perusha, she'll hear Russia as he's a bad guy. He probably beats his children. He probably cheats on his taxes. That's the way many people hear the word Russia. We just mean they're dead generally bad. Whereas we, he's saying, when we use the term Russia, have a more technical definition. That's all we mean by it. Somebody can be, in other words, and this is a point that still resonates with me today, somebody can be, in colloquial terms, a very good person and still be a Russia. Right? And they can still be halachically an evildoer. And that's not always so simple to see, because many people will see somebody, if you see somebody who's Shomer Shabbos and learns Torah regularly and blah, 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 and does all the good stuff, as far as we know, but they do some five or six or seven things wrong halakhically that are serious halakhic problems, they might still be a Russia. And so Moshe is saying, so they can be a Russia in those terms, but people won't see it that way. When we say Russia, it sounds like one thing, and she's going to hear it another way. And therefore, he thinks there's no reason to call her father, or even all conservative rabbis, Rishaim, because to do that, you'd have to first explain carefully what we mean by a Rasha, by an evildoer in the Torah, and what we mean, because the Torah says, this is the source of the idea that a Rasha is somebody who has transgressed a prohibition that can get Malkot, because the Torah says in the context of Malkot, to be careful not to give them too many, and not to give them in a way that gives more, because Malkot is flogging, is lashes, but it's not the death penalty. So the Torah makes it clear that we have to be very careful about how we give them. The Torah says, "V'hayayim bin hakot harasha." It has to be that while one is flogging the rasha, so that means the technical definition of rasha is somebody who has committed a transgression that would earn these kinds of punishments. Other than that, so you have to explain all of that. So he says there's no reason to explain all that. There's no reason to get into the word rasha. You can leave that aside. However, to explain true faith in halacha and in Torah and in the way the Torah works, that he thinks you can do, and you can do it inoffensively. You can do it without offending her, without calling her father names, without any of that. And you can say that all of the people of these other views are promoting a wrong and false view of Judaism without calling them Rishaim, and he thinks that's the best way to teach these students, right? To get the content across without the offensive term. It would be similar to, let's say, Somebody was doing something wrong, and I said, that person, he's an idiot. An idiot is a sensitive term to people. So they hear the word idiot, they react to the word, not to the context. They're much saying, don't use the word then. Just speak about the substance of the issues in a way that makes clear. And now he's not holding back at all on how significantly these people are diverging from acceptable and proper belief in Judaism. It's not toned down what's happening. It's don't use terms that have much broader connotations than people mean. Then, at the very end of the tshuva, there are a couple of other issues that come up that apparently were asked about. One is about tuna fish, which for a long time in the United States of America, the question of how tuna could be kosher was an issue and a problem because the nets caught various kinds of fish, and you didn't know which were which, and there was rumors that there were dolphins included in tuna. In any case, so Moshe says he has to ask his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, who for many years, who still continues to be a Rosh Yeshiva, at YU, at Reitz. He says I have to ask him because he knows about fish, and he says there's some kind of fish that don't have scales and therefore aren't kosher, and therefore you need to know who it is who's being makshir, who is doing the supervision of these fish to make sure that they are in fact kosher fish, to make sure that they have the proper signs of kashrut. When it comes to salmon, it's also important for Moshe things to see the scales on the salmon to know that they're fish, and not to buy, if you can avoid it, not to buy a salmon that has already been skinned, or you know, it's already been cut off, even if it's called salmon, because you don't know, meaning he's talking in a world where there's not necessarily kosher hashgacha on these things, and people won't know if can they buy fresh tuna, can they buy fresh salmon. So Moshe is saying when it comes to tuna, he thinks you have to see that if you're going to buy it without a hashgacha, you have to see the scales on it, because you have to know, because there are certain kinds of, meaning somebody could have said, what if I know that all tuna have scales? So if I see it in a store and it doesn't have scales on it, I don't have to worry about it because I know that it must have had and they fell off or they were taken off. So apparently Rabbi Tendler, who should live a long life, had told his father-in-law that there are kinds of tuna that were caught that are sold as tuna that don't have scales. And with salmon as well, Ramosha is saying he thinks it's better to see the scales on the salmon. It's not good enough that they call things salmon in a store, because it could be that they call something salmon and they have the right to call it salmon, but that doesn't in fact have the signs of kashrut, the signs of being a kosher fish. And he says his son-in-law of Tendler is away in Israel until the end of Elul. We're at the 5th of Av. He's away till the end of Elul. When he comes back at the end of Elul, he'll ask him to talk about, to look into salmon, and he'll let him know what's going on with that. And last piece of the question, there was a woman who had gone to college and stayed from, right, the early 70s, college was not so simple. Even today, it's not so simple. It's an odd thing to watch that today people go to college, and a not insignificant percentage of Orthodox Jews who go to college, to even today, either decrease in their observance or lose it completely. And I hear about, it's not 50% for sure, but it's not 1%. And you hear about it over and over again, about people who lose their sense of observance, and even if they don't lose it, who certainly have a lower level of observance than they did when they were in their parents' home. And that's a challenge that college presents. So that was all part of the whole discussion whether Jews should go to college or not. Today, everybody assumes Jews should go, not everybody, but many in the modern Orthodox world assume it's fine for Jews to go to college without noticing that these consequences that come for many people, not all by far, not a majority, but for many, they don't notice it. So Rav Moshe was being asked about a woman who had gone to college but stayed observant, and she's just about done, and she has a couple of courses left, and there's no real reason to think that those courses, either in their substance or in their environment, will have enough of an impact on her that should be a problem, and they don't teach any kinds of heresy in these courses. It's something she needs for her profession. Nonetheless, Rav Moshe, being asked the question, he thinks it's better to go to a public university than to a Catholic college, meaning the case seems to have been, let's say it would have been easier for her to go to a Catholic college nearby, right, you know, at Georgetown, a Fordham, whatever it is. And Rav Moshe felt, and this is something that also comes up today, and I wonder about it, and people who I speak to assume completely the other way. He says, yeah, he says, no, the other way around. People today assume, oh, it's fine, it's just a course here, a course there. What does it matter that the school is under the auspices of the Catholic Church? He says, better go to a public university. And then one last little piece. When it comes to a loan, this is actually a question that I faced once in my own life. Let's say somebody needs money and I want to lend them money, but the only place they can get the money is by borrowing from a bank. So I'm going to borrow the money from a bank and I'm going to give it to this person who needs the money. And so all I'm looking for, Jews are not allowed to charge other Jews interest. All I'm looking for is for the payment of the interest that I'm going to owe the bank, that this Jew should pay it. So Rav Moshe says you can't just charge the Jew the money, even though theoretically you'd say to yourself, well, all I'm really doing is I'm being the messenger for this Jew to borrow from the bank, and the bank are non-Jews, so that should be okay. Rav Moshe says he thinks it's not okay, that since the money is going from one Jew to the other, and it'll come back from one Jew to the other, he thinks, therefore, that you need a heter iska, you need the document that we fill out that finds a legal fiction way to make it permissible for one Jew to take interest from another, even though there's no meaningful interest from, there's no actual monetary interest from one Jew to the other. Rav Moshe thinks you would nonetheless need a heter iska. So those are the issues that came up in this tshuva that Rav Moshe wrote, this response to Madei for the 5th of Av, Rav Moshe Feinstein, primarily on how to educate the daughter of a conservative rabbi. Have a great day.